This is Bristol, and you are listening to a podcast from the BristolCon Fringe reading series.
Alrighty. This is the part of the evening where we get to ask intelligent or possibly not so intelligent questions of our two readers. And they give us brilliant and insightful answers as to the nature of their work. No, you can sit down. It's all right. I will bring the mic.
Yes,
bring the microphone to you. We can wander around all over the place.
Actually, it's a little bit luxurious for us to be.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, you can do whatever you want. Anyway, Chris, we should probably start with you, as you were first up. I mean, you do a remarkably good line in your stories in impressions of Gamergators. Is this deliberate?
To an extent it is, because they're kind of... I know quite a few people who are like that, who would kind of... I think if they were more into video games, would be Gamergators. So, yeah, there's definite overlap. They both wore fedoras, you know, yeah, I do find kind of fedorable adventurers a bit irresistible as a target. So, yeah, definitely, if you're, you know... yeah, I think there's a definite overlap. It's not consciously about Gamergate, obviously. It's about their social attitudes, which extend into Gamergate.
Okay, and you've got these posters for a play that you're putting on at the Alma Tavern at the end of the month. I see it's from the 24th to the 28th, which sadly I can't make, but hopefully some of the people here will. And it says, a satire on vampires and social media. Which, you know, vampires is good stuff, right? And I'm sure they do have social media. They probably have something called Flutter or something, or whatever bats do. And there's
Von likes two likes.
Yeah.
Like that. Oh, I should rewrite it to put that in.
And all the selfies are blank.
No, I thought of that.
Oh, yeah.
And I guess there's probably a rival social media thing that everybody hates called Staked In, which is actually dead. Tell us a little bit about it, Chris.
Well, as far as Staked In goes, we do have the pun Stake the Internet, which is a hashtag that appears in the show. Yeah, basically, it's a... my plays are much better than my prose works. So, you know, if you liked what you heard from me tonight, then you will love that play. And if you hated it, well, you'll love it because the plays are better. So, by logic, you're going to love it. It's a satire on vampires and social media. So it's essentially a play. It's essentially a comedy. It's comedy through and through. About social media through the medium of vampires. I don't want to give too much away plot-wise, but it's kind of risque, it's quite edgy, it's got everything you expect from a good vampire tale, you know, sort of lots of sex and blood and, you know, devilish things and kidnapping young girls and all that sort of thing. And it's also got lots of jokes about Facebook and Twitter. So, so I think it's a nice mix. It's about social media basically. So it's vampirism is kind of a metaphor in the show for conformity via social media. So it's a metaphor for mostly conformity, and I use vampires as a vehicle for making lots and lots of jokes about our the way we live now, the way we've lived in the last few years since everyone got, you know, smartphones and I went into the wrong pocket. You know, since everyone got these that won't even let you do a nice reading for everyone without screwing you over. So if you spend too much time on social media, or if you're skeptical about social media, and if you like social comedy, then you should come along. And if you like vampires, you'll have a good time.
And presumably you'll prove conclusively that the internet sucks.
Oh! It's a show with a lot of bite.
Excellent. Good. All right. Let's put an end to the puns temporarily. Paul, turning to you, who killed Sherlock Holmes? Well, I know the answer to that. It's Stephen Moffat and Mark Gatiss, isn't it?
There is an element of satire about all current versions of Holmes in the book. We visit
these various studios where three different productions of Holmes are being filmed, and some of them are familiar within the terms of satire. But actually, I'm hoping to get quotes from Rob Doherty, who creates Elementary, and Anne Moffat for the book. So I hope it'll be all recognised as all in good fun. But I'll be getting the quotes before I show them the book.
Well, I'm pleased Elementary is in it, because that's going to make Watson quite interesting.
Oh, no. A satirical, slightly distanced version of all these different Holmeses will be in it. There's a female Holmes in it.
Excellent. Right, yes. Well, we're all now going to be on tenterhooks trying to work out who it is that's killed Sherlock between now and December. So we're probably going to kidnap you over Bristol Con and force you to tell us the answer.
It's terrible writing an actual whodunit. It's the most difficult thing. I'm never going to do that again. Goodness. At least I know who did it.
Neil Gaiman?
Neil Gaiman does not appear in this book.
Hello,
Laura Martin. How about now? Wouldn't that be good if he came on? Yes, it's me. I did it. Hello.
So of course he did it. Killed everyone.
Yes, dear old George. Sorry, what was that, Chris?
Oh, in the game of Holmes, you win or you die. There is no middle ground.
Yeah, I knew really. The holiday from the puns wouldn't last very long. Your characters, you have put them through the ringer totally and utterly. I'm beginning to feel quite sorry for a bunch of coppers.
Excellent. The third book is them trying to recover from what happened in book two. And it's so tough to portray a group of people under tremendous stress and tension and having had horrors in their life without it being dull. So for about the first quarter of the book, we see them from the perspectives of other people who have happier lives, and because it was the only way to do it without the book beginning with doom and then getting steadily gloomier. So, but there is some light in this one. There is some fun.
Well, I'm glad we saw them through the eyes of other people. Otherwise, you might have ended up with Thomas Covenant.
No.
Yes, let's not go there at all. Okay, has anybody else got any questions for our two readers? Don't be shy, people. Don't let Justin get the first question in.
Go on, get Justin.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
You've both clearly written for dramatic presentations as well as writing prose. Does sort of going between one and the other help with writing prose, or the other way around, or do you find it easier to create voices having created dialogue for actual voices?
Okay, yeah, to an extent I do find it easier to have characters that speak or characters that interact with each other and change each other from my experiences as a dramatist, which are more plentiful than my experiences with prose, I must say. But there's another way in which it won't hinder you. You just need to be able to shift between different mindsets. So if you're writing in prose, you have this kind of... if a drama is about... It moves forward. It's always got to move forward. Characters have got to change each other. It's all going to be a sort of action and dialogue based. You can't sort of jump, you can't do the things that you can with a novel where you kind of jump around in time or start talking about, start sort of using description to build in psychology, all of this kind of stuff. You've got to do it through either direction or writing in a drama. So, yeah, they're very different from one another. But I do think that doing drama helps me... make characters that, I hope seem quite lively on the page. But,
Yeah, absolutely. I think the having written for actors does inform your prose and makes it better. I think absolutely.
I think Paul might dispute that you can't jump around in time.
Well spotted, Go. There was another question over here. Was Scott?
Very similar question, actually.
Okay. So Scott was going to ask the same
thing. How sparkly are your vampires?
We have some sparkly vampire Instagram filter jokes.
So they're not sparkly at all. This is not Twilight. This is very anti-Twilight. Dracula is the main source, but you know, other sort of vampire presence in popular culture is the main source, I suppose. But yeah, so what Dracula does with consumer capitalism, I sort of do with social media, if that makes sense, if you've read that. They're not sparkly. I'm very skeptical of gushing teenage romance. You know, I'm far too intellectual. So,
sort of like the original novel is about the social media of the day with Telegraph.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
That's one of the things that.
Sorry, I didn't have the mic for my thing. That's one of the things that sort of kickstarted that idea for me. The way it uses modern technology, the way it was about the 1890s instead of, you know. 1,000 years ago when the boyar killed all the Hungarians, blah, 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 you know. Dracula's not about that. It's about Victorian London.
And it's pretty much a modern-day stroke near-future science fiction novel of Bram Stoker as the William Gibson of his day.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think there's a big intersection between urban fantasy and SF. I mean, the way my coppers take a crime scene apart is so science fiction. You know, they're looking for cues in the same way SF readers do.
Well, I mean, urban fantasy came out of the Minnesota school anyway. I'm sure Emma Bull and whatever were writing science fiction as much as they were writing fantasy. And they weren't trying to, you know, recreate fairies in Arthurian Britain or anything like that. Okay, have we got any... Yeah, Pete.
So you've both written about Sherlock Holmes.
Yes, we have.
What do you think makes him still relevant and popular today, as opposed to somebody, say, like Raffles, that was more popular in the day when Bram Stoker was actually writing him?
Okay, just to give some context to what Pete said, I have done a Sherlock Holmes satire, which was very well received and which starred Tom at the back there as Watson. You see, he's got the beard. If you give him the his 1940s doctor outfit as well, he's perfect, you know. He was very good, and he's going on tour as well. I'm going to make him go on tour. I'm going to whip him into touring. So mine was very much a kind of parody of the notion of, like, the late romantic genius and all that sort of stuff. And I think that's why Holmes sort of sticks with us. I think he's got this kind of mythic quality about him. That I don't think people write that sort of thing anymore. Not necessarily. They might try, but I don't think they really succeed. Where, you know, he's such an intellect that he's able to divine anything through this kind of abductive reasoning. That he's able to sort of look at these clues and you know, it's a fantasy that I think we would all like to have, like a fantasy of intelligence. And I think anyone kind of associated with intelligence, anyone who's more academic than sporty or whatever, as a kid or whatever, I think they identify with Sherlock Holmes in a way, but he's also an action hero. So he's also got this kind of action hero side to him, which I think gives him a very universal appeal. He's doing dangerous deeds, but he's fighting for the law, so there's nothing bad about being him either. There's no, you know, you don't really get much moral ambiguity about being him, so he's a nice fantasy to be. He's a good role model, which is why I think loads of people like him as kids.
Well, the book is basically about that. It's a taking apart of the character of Sherlock Holmes and asking if he is relevant in the modern world. It's also an examination of the methods that I'm not sure... I think Conan Doyle cheats all the time. I'm not sure that Holmes' methods would work at all. In one of the lines in the book is, when you have eliminated the impossible, let me stop you right there. And it's basically a dissection of the character. And so, honestly, my answer is sort of the book, I'm afraid. It's a bit big right now.
Scott, do you want to defend the honour of Raffles?
I love Raffles.
Don't ever buy enough tickets.
To be honest, I'd be more inclined to look at the real pulp fiction heroes of the day, your Sexton Blakes, for example, who the popular conscience has just let go. So who wouldn't be a ghost in your sight?
Well, yeah.
But of their day were actually a lot more popular than Sherlock Holmes ever was. So it's interesting how someone who was considered a fairly meagre version of the pulp fiction hero of the day is now enshrined in British literature as the archetypal detective.
He's a bit in ranking. He's a bit your sort of okay with literature, popular detective of Victoriana, where there are much more popular detectives down in the pulps, which the Strand absolutely wasn't. But he's the one we remembered, possibly because of class.
What I was thinking while you were discussing it is that Holmes is actually a very good 21st century, like late 20th, early 21st century hero. He's a rugged individualist. He's smart rather than fit. He's a geek. He's absolutely a geek. He's in many ways very like the Heinlein competent man. And I think that sits very well with the sort of fiction that we like at the moment.
Although one thing that has been lost is that Conan Doyle absolutely thinks he's a completely functional gentleman who can fit into society. I like that about Elementary a lot. That's a Holmes who's eccentric, but when he needs to be, he can absolutely sit down at a table and charm and enthrall a crowd. That's in the original Holmes, and that's the bit which we tend to edit out now because it doesn't suit our Asperger's thing.
So he's this perfectly normal, functional gentleman and an opium addict.
Yeah. But it was legal, you know.
I was going to say, that's absolutely true.
But it was legal. I mean, it was kind of frowned upon to do too much opium or whatever, but it was perfectly legal.
And he and Watson are meant to be having it away with prostitutes.
Yeah.
We interpret that as gay now, but them living together as bachelors, they're meant to be... being civil towards ladies and letting their sexual side out in another direction. That's absolutely implicit in the coding then, and that coding's gone now.
Yeah, that's, I think it's very... Sorry, what was that?
I need to go and reread them all now. Well,
people didn't assume that you had it away with your male best mate. People assumed that you were having it away outside of wedlock, you know what I mean? But yeah, with Holmes and the fact that we need him to be a bit odd, I think it's because he's kind of too perfect he's too perfect for our sensibilities. If he can be all of these amazing things, that's super smart, super, you know, great action hero, blah, blah, blah. If he can be all of these things and also a perfectly functional member of society, I think that gets our envy up a bit. I think that makes us stew a bit, with envy. I don't think we like that. I think we want people to have flaws. We're better than the Victorians, I think, at wanting people to have flaws. It's a very 20th, 21st century thing. Mm. And I think that's what we do to Holmes. We make him more our own through doing that.
He's above the law. He will let people off.
Moving it away from Sherlock Holmes for a moment, Paul, I notice West Ham have been doing an awful lot better since your first book was published. Have they publicly thanked you yet?
I've had an interview with some West Ham fanzines. In my first book, anybody who scores a hat-trick against West Ham is horribly murdered. And which the West Ham fans think is a happier policy for Murray of Britain. And actually, the last person until very recently who had scored a hat trick against West Ham was Wayne Rooney, and that was about a decade ago. So the legend doesn't seem to be working.
How do you know Wayne Rooney is still alive? He's written his autobiography for heaven's sake. Well, these are several volumes there. Yeah, he definitely had a ghostwriter for that. Okay, do we have any more questions for our two readers? Pat?
Well, actually, my question's for Paul. I know I've heard what Neil thought of the portrayal in the book. Have you gotten any flack from any of his fans?
In the second book, Neil Gaiman appears as himself with his permission and cooperation, which was lovely of him. But every now and then on Twitter especially, I get people going, "You didn't!" And then a couple of tweets later, they'll be, "Does he know about this?" Yeah. Like I would want to open myself up to being sued by one of the richest writers on the planet. He probably wouldn't sue. He'd probably just be disappointed in me.
That's so much worse, isn't it?
but my copy editor put a big red circle around his first appearance with in block capitals, "Does he know?"
Has Amanda written a song about you yet?
That would be really nice. She's in the book too.
Yeah, I spotted that. It does remind me, actually, though, that I should ask you about some of your other stuff, because you do write comics and things as well, and I gather one or two things have been bubbling under. So what can we look forward to?
I'm sorry, that's the dinner. thank you. I'll be here all evening. Yeah. I've got this huge Doctor Who Comics crossover event coming this summer. Titan Comics are suspending all of their regular Doctor Who titles for 5 weeks across August and given me a Three Doctors crossover to do five weekly issues thereof. With lovely art by Neil Edwards, I'm so pleased to be doing it. It's the 10th, 11th and 12th Doctors together having an adventure. And I can't actually say the title or any other details, but that, yeah.
And Mr. Edwards has a very interesting Twitter handle.
Oh, yes. The Bristol Board, he calls himself, because that's what they draw on. Bristol, the standard comics art thing to draw on is a Bristol Board. I'm not sure why it's a Bristol Board. It's interesting, isn't it?
Yes, well, we'll...
And comics-wise, I've got coming out this year a creator-owned miniseries, a one-off, and an enormous other thing that I really cannot say anything about. But there's at least three, possibly four, other comics projects I'm doing this year, which haven't been announced yet. It's wonderfully, wonderfully busy.
Chris, have you got anything else you want to talk about?
Wanted to ask myself. Oh, if I wanted to add, okay, fine. Yes, I suppose, well, you could probably find lots of interviews online about this, actually, but yes, I do have this coming up in the Alma Tavern, as we've mentioned, the 24th to the 28th of March, so it's in 2 weeks, well, it's in 1 week, actually. 1 week and 1 day, yeah. Which is, you know, ooh, but no, it's not. I've got it under control. It's looking really good, actually. I'm the director as well, so I'm also sorting it out on the getting actors to do things with their physical bodies level. And I promise they don't read it from phones. So tonight's technical difficulties do not represent my work at all. yeah. Biting, satirical, fun, absurd, and you'll have a great time. You'll probably walk away thinking about your life a bit more. So, yeah, thank you very much.
I want to see those actors doing something with their ectoplasmic bodies. do plays of Paul's novels. Alrighty.
Collected short stories this summer as well. I think that's it. I'm busy.
Does Caroline ever get to see you?
We really hardly see each other. We're both really busy.
Okay, any last questions for our two readers? No. Has anybody got any announcements that they want to make? Or failing anything else? Pete, have you got an announcement?
We can, yes. Exactly, yes. What I'm about to do. Yeah, on March the 28th, my lovely assistant will show the book. we're launching North by Southwest at Forbidden Planet midday, I think it is, isn't it? 1 o'clock. There you go. I don't even know the time of my own launch. And we've got copies for sale tonight. So you could get one ahead of the game, or you can get one from Forbidden Planet, or you can get them online on Amazon, or you can get them online from Tangent. And all good bookshops, etc., etc. And if you do buy a copy, it'd be lovely if you could review it for us.
We have a provisional date booked also with Central Library, which is the 28th of April, to do readings in the evening. So that's yet to be confirmed. So we'll announce that at next month's Fringe and look out for it on Twitter and Facebook, etc.
And that, of course, is for North by Southwest, an anthology of stories by Bristol writers, edited, it says here, by Joanne Hall, And I see there are people like Ros Clark and Des Fisher and John Hawkes-Reed and Kevlin Henney and Ian Milstead, Justin Newland and Pete Sutton, all of whom who have read at Bristol Con Fringe before.
Most of them are here tonight.
And what possibly one or two other people that are here that I didn't know, but you can beat me over the head afterwards about that. Pete, another announcement.
I edit a magazine called Far Horizons, which is science fiction, fantasy and horror, and we're 1 year old next month, and we're doing a shout out for submissions. We'd love to actually have a bumper bonanza issue and have lots and lots of people send us stories. So up to 4,000 words long, or you don't have to be stories, it can be interviews, book reviews, film reviews, articles, art. Send us your stuff and we'd take it, probably.
Don't make promises.
Probably.
Any more announcements? Jo?
Hello. Yeah, next month's Fringe is the 20th of April, and it's going to be one of our speed reading open mics. So if you have anything that you can read in under 5 minutes, and you don't mind getting buzzed off at the end of it if you haven't finished, then come along and we'll try and cram in as many of you as possible. Also, the Fantasy SF Society pub night is in here next week on Monday, which happens to be my birthday, so if you can all bring cake, that'd be lovely.
Isn't it your job to bring the cake?
I brought cake tonight, you missed it because you were late.
Yeah, the cake was... The cake was delicious, so those of you who were late, don't be late again, because there might be cake, yes. You do know that everything I write takes about 6 minutes to read, don't you?
That's possible. We might be able to extend it if you're right.
We shall see. We shall see.
What we did at BristolCon was we had a vote at the end for whose ending we wanted to hear the most of the people who'd been buzzed off early. So we could do that again. And you just have to make sure you really win everyone over.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so if we don't have any more questions or announcements, I hereby declare tonight's BristolCon Fringe closed. Thank you very much, for everybody, for coming, and thank you in particular to Chris Cutting and Paul Cornell for their fabulous work.
BristolCon Fringe is a monthly reading series produced by the BristolCon Foundation. Our thanks to the Shakespeare Tavern for providing us with a venue. The music at the beginning of this podcast is The Future by Chevy 174.